Hello. How are you today? There you are.
Hi, Melissa. How are you doing?
I am well, thank you. I am so very thrilled to meet you. So glad we could chat.
It's a pleasure to meet you. Let me tell you, I am officially retired as of yesterday at the University of Georgia after a total of 50 years of university teaching. And when I went to get on this, suddenly it says, oh, you can't use this. You have to go to a new account. And so
Oh
I managed to get in the new account and get on. But I thought, what the devil is this? I use bad language probably too much. My wife often says that, but boy, I was cussing up a storm and trying to just get on this thing, but it finally worked. So it's
well,
good to see you in person.
good to see you. It's been a trying day, because we just had a nasty little storm, so I was
Oh.
speaking with Alexander Capron today, and we could not proceed because Zoom would not behave. So I'm going to keep my fingers crossed that this will behave. I'm going to turn this off for a second because I want to tell you something that doesn't go on this take.
But just along those lines, I'm going to be taking a tour. That's one thing I do occasionally, a guided to a river tour, and I've done a couple on the Seine and the Rhine on World War II, but I'm going to do one coming up in February on Cambodia and
Oh.
Vietnam. And the interesting aspect of that is, yeah, I've taught that for many years, but my son, who's a graduate of Oberlin, was actually in 5th Special Forces Group Airborne in the Iraq War, and those men are the ones who fought the secret war in Laos in the Vietnam War. Two of them were black who were awarded medals of honor in that war, and he's met one of them. He is so pleased. So I finally said, well, listen, you actually work. He's a senior social worker in the VA. You actually work with the veterans and so on, and you know the history. My wife, Diane, says she's not coming. I said, how about you? Think you can get leave to come? He said, I'll do my best. So that will be very interesting. Yeah, because I've read a great deal about that. That's my generation. And I have always thought that God was watching over me when he gave me a high number in the draft lottery because that was not a war. What I saw, I'd actually met. I'd been in France in '62 when I was 18 before I went to Swarthmore. Met a whole number of French kids my age whose fathers had fought in Indochina, and to listen to them, I thought, "Oh God, we're going to get in that. We should leave it all alone and let the Vietnamese have their own country and be done with it." But lucky, just lucky.
Well, I'm glad you were lucky. A number of your classmates have had very interesting, harrowing experiences avoiding the draft. And it's part of the conversation for this group that essentially is being asked to recall their experiences from 59 to 66. And so many things happened during that period to really change people's perspectives and their experiences. So I will be along the way asking you about, if you had a similar switch. But I believe it is your roommate I spoke to, and we have a brand new baby in the house, and I forgot to look this up because we have a brand new baby in the house. But were you roommates with Michael Manoff?
Excuse me, what was it, Michaels?
Was it Michael Manoff that was your roommate? Or was it Jerry
No,
Gallagher?
actually, no. Interestingly enough, I had one roommate my freshman year, Dick Shyman, who was a really good soccer player. And then I had three roommates my sophomore year. God, let's see, Woody, and what's it? He's an engineer. Now they're all white. Scheinman and I roomed together as part of a quad. And then Woody and Lou roomed together on the other side. And then after that, I became a proctor down in Mary, first in Wharton D section, and then in Mary Lyons, and never roomed with anyone else again until I met my wife.
So, well, you were a proctor. That's surprising. Yeah, no, I had
roommates. Jack Nagel.
I said you were a proctor. That is exciting.
Yeah, well, I had an interesting career at Swarthmore because when I came, let me back up a little. I grew up in Alabama, Georgia, and North Carolina. My parents, I was born in Trenton, New Jersey, and my parents moved south when I was one in 1945 because my mother, who was originally from South Carolina, told my father when he said, you know, he had graduated Phi Beta Kappa from Rutgers, was getting his master's in French from University of Pennsylvania. And he just lamented one day, he was teaching at a high school that he would like to teach college. And my mother just said to him candidly, if you want to, you're going to have to go south to an HBCU. And so he did. And Talladega College in Talladega, Alabama, took him, and away we went. Many years later, when I realized there was such a thing as the Black Migration North, which my mother's family had participated in 1919 when they moved from South Carolina to New York. And I asked my parents, what the hell were you doing going south to Alabama? I said, South Jersey was bad enough as I understood it, but Alabama? Mm-hmm. And that's when they explained to me the situation. So I grew up in the South until I was 15. And then just sort of fate intervenes. And since my father had been an expert on West African philosophers and writers, and many of them ended up being the leaders in the West African countries like Leopold Senghor in Senegal. And when Republic of Guinea became independent from the French Union in 1959, the French embassy in Paris knew that my father had met all these people. He had been doing research on a book there on Francophone literature. And so they recommended he get the position because they really didn't have any experts in West Africa. So, he was interviewed J. William Fulbright of the Foreign Relations Committee said he was one of the very best qualified individuals they had ever interviewed for a position. So my sister was 8 years older than I, we persuaded him, my parents said, you got to take us. You can't leave us here, whatever you do. So we went to Guinea, and that's where I encountered something I hadn't even thought about it. I wanted to be a fighter pilot and an aeronautical engineer. When I went to Guinea, it was like roots before roots. I'm meeting people, I'm talking people, in particular when one of the Guinean members of the embassy said, yeah, we're going to take a trip up country. And he looked at me and my father, and he said, you are going to meet your brothers when you get up in the Fouta Jalon, which is a mountain country. And I didn't think much about it. And then when we got up there, I'm looking out the window, I'm thinking, I said, hey, Dad, these guys look like us. I mean, it's like, and he starts laughing. Well, they greeted him as a long lost brother, made him honorary member of the Fulani tribe. And I thought, well, okay, probably that's not the way it happened. Some white guy in the way got in the way when we came back. But I knew forever after that those were the people that I was descended from. And beyond that, the other combination aspect of the combination was a number of these men who were in the army had fought in what were called the Tirailleurs Senegalais, the Senegalese infantry who served in World War I. And I wrote about them in one of my other books, The Great War in Imperial History. Mm-hmm. But they also fought in Indochina. So I'm meeting these men and I'm thinking, okay, my father had taken me when we were in France, and later on we were in France in 1962 to visit these monuments, World War I. And I saw the monument with the 369th on it. And it didn't register then. It just registered that, wow, this is great history, visiting these graves where these men had fought, and thinking, geez, I met Senegalese infantry. And it was when I got to Swarthmore. First of all, they sent me to private school in New England for the last 2 years of high school, which upped my game tremendously, because coming out of either a black or white high school in the South, it didn't make any difference. Your education was not up to snuff. I had been one of the first students when I was in 10th grade before we left. The Methodist Church decided they wanted to integrate, at least have students, white students meet black students. And so I and a young woman who was two grades lower, Sandra Chris, and I were asked to go to this meeting with all these white Methodist students. And when they got done with the meeting, it was interesting to them. I had gone to 1 year in elementary school in New Jersey. It was still segregated, but if you went north, you know, you went to watch the Brooklyn Dodgers, you saw black and white players cooperating, the fans, stands were integrated and so on. And when these kids came up to us afterward, after asking whether we were boyfriend and girlfriend, which we were not, but they said, you know, we're really shocked. You're just like us. And I had this way, my eyes kind of go sideways sometimes. And I didn't say anything. I thought, shit, you didn't know that? I said, we're all human beings. All I thought was, I wandered away and I said to my father afterwards, I said, that's a fundamental problem when they're just understanding something. And actually, no, we're not really just like you are. Our experience has been very different in this country. But yeah, we are certainly intelligent. In fact, one of the reasons I actually came back south in the end to teach was that my principal, when I was leaving Durham, principal of Hillside High, called me and he said, John, we're really sorry to see you go. And I said, well, I'm really sorry to leave because I got friends here. And he said, well, we intended to have you integrate either Duke or UNC Chapel Hill. He said, yeah, you're a tremendous student in literature and so on and so forth. You've got great grades at the top of the class. And I never forgot that. So I went to Mount Hermon for 2 years, graduated third in my class, did well. Also learned that people in New England really weren't used anymore to black folks. In fact, they were less used because there were a few of them up there. They would always put, there were two black guys in each class and we roomed together and got along real well. He came from Harlem. Here's this character coming from the deep South. But he also realized that there was, how did he put it? It was after an incident in the dining hall where you had to have a job at Mount Hermon. And I'm working in the dining hall. I'm putting dishes out with a good friend of mine, a white boy whose parents were in the diplomatic service too. And we're in the kitchen with these really heavy dishes. I don't know what they were made out of. And all of a sudden, I hear this rainbow. I didn't think anything about it. I thought, I don't know what the devil is going on. I went out doing the dishes. And my friend after the third rainbow said, John, I think he's talking to you. And I looked at this one fellow's name was John Meter. I looked at him and said, like hell he is. That's not my name. He knows what my name is. And I turned around and I said, are you calling me? He said, yes, Rainbow. And that was one of my fundamental problems my parents had warned me about. I had a ferocious temper. I didn't mellow out for years and years, but I started picking up these dishes like frisbees and throwing them at this guy across the dining hall. If one of them had ever hit him, would have cleaned his clock. And I was cursing. I just lost everything. And finally, my friend grabbed me. He said, you guys, I said, I'll kill us. Well, when the head of the dining hall came in, his guy in the kitchen said he called me Rainbow. I'll kill him if I get a chance. You either call me by my name or you don't call me anything. Well, turned out being the son of an ambassador really didn't hurt much, because the one thing they didn't want to have problems with was the State Department. It cut both ways. When they had the first Freedom Rides, they sent a bus down from Mount Hermon. I said, hey, I'm going. They said, no, you aren't going, because we can't take a chance. They wouldn't let me. They said, because we can't take a chance on your getting involved in something and your father being in the diplomatic service. We've got to keep you away. We're sorry, but you just cannot go. And they wouldn't let me go. And I thought, okay, well, I can understand that. The last thing I would have wanted to do was to reflect on my father. Although knowing my father full well, my father would have said, go to hell ahead and do what you want to do. But they didn't. That was not what they were listening for. So I came to Swarthmore because by my senior year at Mount Hermon, I'm looking for colleges. And the college guidance people are saying, hey, you third student in the class, you're the only one with athletics and letters, said you should go to Harvard or Yale. And I thought, it's really cold up here. I don't like running in cold weather. I'm thin. I'm not going to get any wider. I got to get out of here. And I was looking at a Time magazine. It was early that fall. And it said, it had the ranks of the top 10 small colleges. And Swarthmore was at the very top. And it said, and it has an honors program. I thought, okay. Great school, Philadelphia, real good track country. Co-ed, since the girls were across the river, and it was sort of artificial. And so I went down to Swarthmore for my interview, and interviewed with Bob Barr, who was dean of men at that time. And I think he probably thought I was either really arrogant or just not really knowledgeable, because we're part the way through the interview and he says, well, what do you think of Swarthmore? I said, well, you know, I'd had the campus tour. And he said, well, your tour guide was Paul Booth, who was the head of SDS at the time. Mm-hmm. And he said, did that have any effect on you? I said, no, I wasn't paying any attention to what he was saying. I was looking at the campus and thinking, this place is beautiful. This is where I would like to be. I said, what difference does it make who your guide is? That's only one person. But I sort of liked the atmosphere. And then I said, you know something else? You have an honors program here. And I'd like to do the honors program. At which point, his eyes got kind of wide. And he said, you know, you have to be able to earn the average your first 2 years to get into honors. And I looked at him and said, well, I'll do that. And I think that kind of stunned him. I guess he figured I was cocky, but I wasn't. I was just speaking. My parents were a tremendous influence on me. And I had been brought up to believe if I put my mind to it, there was nothing I could not do. I have to conquer my temper, but by God, I had succeeded. I went to Mount Hermon, starting with B's and ending with A's, the 2-year period, and upping my game. And all I thought was, whatever challenge you throw at me, I will deal with it. It's as simple as that. And I wasn't thinking beyond that. And so I applied to Swarthmore. It's the only place I applied. And my roommate is at Mount Hermon at that time was a white fellow who applied and didn't get in. And he got kind of huffy about it. Mm-hmm. And he said, he forgot himself. He said, you only got in because you're black. Mm-hmm. And I looked at him and said, my average is a lot higher than yours. And you don't have any varsity letters in any sports. I said, it has nothing to do with my being black. I'm a better student than you are. Forget about it and move on. So, you know, I get to Swarthmore in 1962. And it's the place I wanted to be. I discovered when I got there, I think there were two upper class women, they're both juniors. And then there was my incoming class. We had, I think, four men, Jim Smith, Al Chappelle. I always forget the little guy who dropped out and became a radical very early on because he changed his name to a very radical name. And I don't want to go back to his original name, but he didn't stay long. And then myself. And then there were four black women, Judy Richardson. Mm-hmm. And I'm probably going to forget. I remember Judy because I'd actually taken her out once. And I thought she was very interesting, but really dismayed when she left. I thought, oh, she's left. Well, whatever. But the thing was that Al and I graduated on time. Jim graduated a year late and got married by that time. And I went on to grad school at Penn, a quick outline, because I didn't realize I'd become a historian. I got there and the first year, okay, I'm taking foreign languages. I was good at foreign languages. So I thought, okay, I'll do German and French. I was doing perfectly fine in my other classes, but it was the second semester of first world history we had, and then we had modern Europe. And I was in a class taught by Paul Bike, who was a very quiet, distinguished, white-haired gentleman, never raised his voice. And I was sitting in there. We had our first hour test. He's giving the hour test back, and he says, some of these papers are so good they could have been written by graduate students. Mm-hmm. He said, if you got an A on your paper, you need to come see me about being a history major. Mm-hmm. I didn't open my paper. I was sitting next to a friend of mine, a young white woman by the name of Maureen called Beta, so I'll never forget Maureen. Maureen leaves over, she said, John, what did you get? She said, I got an A. I said, well, I'm really glad to hear that, Maureen. She said, why don't you look at your paper? I said, I don't think I really want to. And she said, look at your paper, please. I can't stand it. So I opened it. I said, hey, I got an A too. And so she said, I'm going to go talk to him. I said, hey, okay, good. She said, you come along with me for support. I said, he's a nice guy. He's not going to be anything like that. She said, are you my friend? I said, yes, Maureen, I am your friend. I sit next to you. And I ended up being history majors, but I went into honors, modern Europe, and came out with an honors degree. And when it came time to go to grad school, I had the option of Harvard, Columbia, and Penn, which are the three schools I had applied to. And ironically, my father had gotten his PhD in Romance Languages at Penn many years before, but I picked Penn because first of all, it had a German specialist, but number two, they gave me a complete and total free ride. One of the professors they had at Swarthmore when I was there was a Russian history prof, Alexander Ryazanovsky, and he basically said, I want you to come to Penn. He said, we got a German historian coming in, that's what you want to do. I went to Penn, but on the way, it comes back to Swarthmore, because a lot of the questions you've asked are about activism. I've never considered myself an activist. I think people should be really honest about this. I was always a loner. My mother once recalled to me, this is in Talladega, and I was about 7 or 8 then. And I was sitting in the house, and I had an electric train. I'm diddling around with it on the floor. And she comes in and says, why are you in here? Why don't you go outside and play? And I says, nobody out there to play with. She looks out the window. She said, all your friends are out there. Sit down the next yard. And I looked up at her and said, there's nobody out there I want to play with right now.
All right.
So she said, okay. And my sister was 7 years older. So there was a wide gap there. In fact, when I appeared, my mother asked her to hold me. She looked at my mother and said, I told you I wanted a baby sister. He's yours. You hold him. It took a while for my sister and me to get along. But I sort of grew up because we moved from Talladega to Atlanta and North Carolina. And each time you moved, you reestablished yourself, a new set of friends. And then in Guinea, and then up to secondary school. So I became used very early on to basically thinking for myself and making my own decisions because my parents weren't there. I would explain things to them in letters. My sister was already a professional social worker, and I stayed with her and my aunt. They were up in New Jersey when I was on vacation, but a lot of times I didn't come on vacation because I got a job. But there were things that I went to Swarthmore with based on my father, who he and my uncle, Fred Morrow, was the first Black man ever to be on the White House staff in the Eisenhower administration. And he wrote a number of books. It was a very difficult situation, we learned, but I learned from listening to them talk when we would visit him. Just how tough it was to be the one Black guy trying to get these things done. But he was the man behind the scenes when he got Eisenhower to meet with Martin Luther King, Abernathy, A. Philip Randolph, and the rest of them, Whitney Young. He had arranged that with a great deal of difficulty. And so I'm thinking, okay, there's room for people. He was a lawyer. He'd been a major in the artillery in World War II. And with these two, my sister was the first Black baby born in the ward, the children's ward at Mercy Hospital in Trenton, New Jersey.
Okay.
These were sometimes individual, sometimes joint efforts where you pull other people in. And I thought, well, there have been two fundamental things parents always said. You always have to fight for the right thing, justice. So if you don't like injustice, if you don't like the way things are going, you need to do something about it. They never said you needed to band together with other people to do something about it. It's like they just looked at me and said, you need to do something about it. I thought, well, okay, it seems fair if you actually are in a position to do something. You shouldn't just sit on your butt and do nothing. You need to do something. And at the same time, there was this obligation to do well academically beyond the sports. And the way I got into, and what I'll, it's not activism, but the way I really got into this whole business, because coming through and coming out in 66, I had problems anyway that my father noted, but I felt them later. My junior year, I went out with a very attractive white girl, and my father would come down to watch the track meets, and she always came to watch the track meets. And one day he took me aside as he was leaving. He said, have you noticed any change in the attitudes of any of the administrators and faculty here since you began to date her?" I said, "Well, no," but I said, "if you ask me that, that means you have noticed something." He said, "Yeah, a couple of your administrators." Now, I didn't have a lot of contact with them. He said, "You know, they used to speak to me before, you know, I've been coming to watch your meet since we came home middle of freshman season." He said, "They've always spoken to me. Now, when I come in and she's sitting with me in the stands, they won't even look at me." And I said, "Not as liberal as they pretend to be," which was not surprising given what I'd seen in Mount Hermon and so on. And I just registered that up. And I did well. I have my issues, more personal. I was still trying to work out my temper problems. And occasionally my temper would come out with, how would I put it, the wrong thing. This is sort of, I was in the Rhodes Hopper my senior year. I thought it'd be kind of interesting to go to London study. And I went to, applied to go in New Jersey, which was my father's home state, original home state. What I didn't know and what I didn't think about it was, I said, okay, the interview would be at Rutgers. And since he taught at Rutgers, he was department head, Romance Languages. I said, hey, I can ride down with him and ride back. And he didn't say anything to me until after the interviews, but I went through three rounds. I got to the final round. In the final round, I walked in and the atmosphere changed totally. All of a sudden, these interviewers started attacking Swarthmore. I mean, it was like the way it's small, it's and just demeaning it. And I'm sitting there thinking, wait, it's not about Swarthmore. You're supposed to be asking me questions. This is me time, whatever. I had a 30-minute interview. They wasted 20 minutes just spewing vitriol about Swarthmore. And at the end of it, they said, "What do you have to say about this?" And I looked at them and said, "I don't have anything to say about it. You have any questions you want to ask me, since that's what the interview is supposed to be about? I don't care what you think about Swarthmore. That's your business. I think it's a good school." They had the couple of questions at the end. I didn't make it. I knew I wouldn't, given what had happened. The two individuals they picked, what I thought was funny was the among ourselves, we had pre-selected who we thought should get it. And I was one, and this Irish kid from New York who played basketball was the other. And they picked two people who had no athletics. I thought, who cares? But I was mad. And I went home that night, and I told my father what had happened. He said, "I should have told you. He said the chair of the committee, Mason Gross, was the president of Rutgers, and the faculty senate, which my father chaired, and the president were loggerheads. He said, you probably shouldn't have come home to New Jersey. I said, well, you didn't know that. I didn't know it. I put my fist into a metal cabinet that night. I was so mad. And I went back to Swarthmore the next day. And I'm walking across campus. With us, it turned out we weren't girlfriend, boyfriend anymore, but really good friends, young woman I dated. And all of a sudden, Dean Stott and Dean Barr come running out of the front door of Parrish. And they look at me and they say, John, we just got a call from the Rhodes people. And they said, if you apply again next year, you'll be sure to get a Rhodes. They said, you were outstanding. Temper. I looked up at them and I said, tell the Rhodes people for me, they can stuff their fucking scholarship up their asses. I said, I want it this year. They basically took me out. They wasted my interview. I appreciate you gentlemen coming out and telling me this, but I'm never applying for it again because I don't need a Rhodes scholarship to define me. And I walked away. Stott and Barr never forgot that. I didn't get Phi Beta Kappa at Swarthmore, not because I didn't get the grades, I found this out later, but because they decided I didn't have the temperament to be worthy of a Rhodes scholarship. And all I thought was, well, if it means holding your temper in crucial moments, then yeah, I don't have the temperament, but I'll curse you out if I don't like what I think is going on. And so I went merrily on. And so I finished the year, I'm going to Penn. And then my very good friend, Jack Nagel, and we have been tight since freshman year because he was a half mile on track team and I was a quarter mile. And Jack comes up to me, it's early spring semester, he says, and I said, well, where are you going, Jack? He said, well, they're starting an upward bound program here on campus, and they're going to bring Chester kids up to Swarthmore to study. He said, black kids from Chester. I said, huh, now that's interesting. He said, you got a job this summer? I said, hell no, I don't have a job. I haven't even thought anything. I just want to get out of here and go. He said, well, come on. So I get up there and Dick James, Richard James, who was a black fellow from Chester at that time, was representing him. And they were talking about it. And James, I realized it was a setup. Now, for those of you who want to have Rhodes scholarships, maybe this isn't exactly what you want to do. And I looked at Jack and I said, you set me up, didn't you? And we're still good friends today. We've been good friends forever. I said, you set me up. I said, okay. So when they asked questions, I said, I raised my hand. I said, okay, Richard James, I know you're referring to me. I said, I got news for you. If you will accept me on this program, you have a counselor. I said, because Jack had told me about it. I liked the notion of working with younger folks, high school kids, and getting them ready for college. So let's do it. And off we went. I was counselor the first year. And I ultimately became associate director. I spent 3 years that I was at Penn in grad school. During my summers, I didn't take courses or anything else. In fact, my fellowship there said I should be taking summer courses. And I basically told them I need to earn money to come back to Penn. And so I'll be working Upward Bound. So I stayed with Upward Bound. And that's where I really found my calling, my niche. I had not thought much about it, but it it actually probably ended up leading to my being a college professor. Because the first, this is an absolutely new program, and here we are. We've got to recruit kids to come to the program because it's not that well known in Chester. So they dropped a bunch of us down in the streets of Chester. And so here I am in what some folks would call the ghetto and wandering around. All of a sudden, oh, right next to this big apartment building, I see these kids and I think, yeah, those are ninth graders. I know they got to be ninth or 10th graders, okay? So I know these black guys playing basketball, big guys playing basketball on this court next to them. I went and sat down with the kids and I said, yeah, I got a proposition for you. Are you doing anything this summer? And they said, no. I said, well, Swarthmore College, it's 20 miles up the road, has this great program for just for you guys. I don't know how your grades are. If you're doing well, you can always do better. And if you're having problems, it's a program that will help you get through high school and do well. And so I'm having a good time talking with them. All of a sudden, turn around, and these guys who were playing basketball have stopped playing basketball and have come over. And one of the guys looked at me and he said, are you talking to my boys? And I looked at him and said, they all your children? And he said, no. I said, you mean they're your boys? Okay, I said, I get it. He said, well, what are you talking to them about? I said, I'm talking to them about an opportunity. It's an opportunity to help them do better in school and do better in life. I said, I'd be talking to you and the rest of your boys playing basketball, but you're too old. So I can't, so I need to talk to them. He said, well, where are you from? So I explained. He said, you don't belong here. I said, I admit that. I don't belong here. But I'm here because I want to talk to these fellows about coming to the program. He said, you know, we could beat the hell out of you. I looked at him and said, yeah, I'm sure you could. But I'll make a deal with you. I said, we have a choice here. I'm willing to fight you guys one at a time. Not too good. If you're a wrestler, you're cocky as hell. I mean, you're also mean. I said, I'll fight you one at a time. I said, or why don't you just let me talk to the guys and I'll be on my way. I'll be out of your hair. He looked at me. And I know he thought I was a fool because when I stood up, I was like 5'10 and 150 pounds. And this guy's got size on me, but not enough. Well, he said, okay. You got 10 minutes. We're going to go away. You got 10 minutes to finish your deal. And if you're not going by then, we will beat the daylights out of you. I said, thank you. They left. And these five boys, they said, we don't believe you. I said, why don't you believe me? They said, they would have killed you. They said, it didn't mean that much to you that you would get killed to get us to come on this program? I said, I actually hadn't thought about being killed, guys. I thought I was gonna get the crap beaten out of me, but that would not be the first time in my life. I said, but yeah, it's important to me. And they looked at me and they said, we'll all be there. And I thought, okay, we're off to a start. And when the program got started, I thought, what should I teach? And I decided I'd take John Hope Franklin's Abridged History from Slavery to Freedom. And we'd read African-American history. Got in the first class. One of the guys says to me, and this is kind of funny, because he later went to Swarthmore. I'm going to forget his name. Roscoe was his first name. He was a character. He had a gold tooth. I said, we're going to read 25 pages of this a night. He said, oh, no, we're not. He said, I'm not reading it. I said, why aren't you reading it? He said, I don't want to read it. Summertime. I said, listen, you came to the program. Just cooperate. Try the book. You might like it. It's actually well written. It's a good book. Oh, no. I'm not reading it. I said, listen, I can't make you read this, but you're setting a bad example for the rest of these guys here. I mean, nobody else is just out and out saying they won't read it. And here you are just being defiant. He said, you going to make me read it? I said, I'm not allowed to lay hands on you. But if I were, I'd make you read it all right. He said, you want to be like that? And he said, oh, you go, no, man. So then he transforms the whole thing into my nickname from the very first day became Bird, because wearing shorts, I got skinny legs. That's in my family. And so I became the Bird because I had skinny legs. And he said, oh, Bird's going to make me do this. And I said, I didn't say that, Roscoe. Oh, yes, but you did. Can I say it? So by later on that evening, the whole camp is live with the rumor that Bird and Roscoe are going to have a duel. Oh, mercy. And when we get out at the end of the camp before the kids home, and he's there and the whole camp, and I come out and the whole camp is crowded. Yeah, you go. Oh, man, he's up there juking and stuff like that. And I said, Roscoe, you're a fool, but I can't hit you. I cannot hit you. You know that very well. So I said, this is the way we're going to have our duke. First shot, you better mean it. In other words, since you're just going to be there, I said, you better try to hit me and knock the living daylights out of me, but I'm not going to swing back at you, and that's all there is to it. So he comes up and he swung, and that's one thing about my father raised me to do judo, boxing, and wrestling. Mm-hmm. I just grabbed his fist as I took it by my face, took his hand down into his crotch, grabbed it with my other hand, picked him up off the ground, and stuffed him upside down in a trash can.
Oh.
And the whole camp is going, whoa, Bird, he's up there. Get me out of here. Get me out of here. Bird really wipes it. And I leaned over in the trash can. I said, you going to read the damn book? He said, yes, I'm going to read the book. I said, you going to encourage everybody else to read the book? Yes, I'm going to encourage everybody else to read the book. So I got him out. I spent those 3 years were three of the best summers I had working with those guys, some of them and girls as well. Some of them went on to Swarthmore. One of them went on to Penn while I was a grad student there, Bruce Collins, who was a star hurdler and a good student. And I really enjoyed it. Jack was in the first summer, but he really didn't stay because he had to go on to Yale. But since I was at Penn, I could come out. And that's how I met my wife, because she was a freshman. I was a senior. She was a Diane Batts, black girl from Philadelphia who had gone to Girls High. And we met under not the most auspicious circumstances. She swore I didn't speak to her when she was a freshman, but she's not one to take any stuff off anyone. And so a couple of months into her freshman year, I was walking across campus to the library, and she's coming towards me, going to the dining hall, and suddenly I see this hand in my face, and she's about 5'9", she's almost as tall as I am. And I said, yes. And she said, you know, it wouldn't hurt you to speak, especially since there's no one around to see you do it. Damn. Ooh. And so she walked on by and I turned around and I said, hello. as she disappeared. But come her between sophomore and junior year, she was looking for a job, and she worked with little kids and Head Start, and had been doing that for years, high school and so on. Fine. I was associate director and ran the daytime program, and the director and I interviewed. And she said she knew she wasn't going to get the job. And I just laughed because he asked me, he says, pretty clear, his name is Don Cheeks. He said, it's pretty clear you two have had an interaction. I said, yeah, it was very negative, Don. I mean, she sawed me off at the neck. So it was, he said, well, what do you think about it? I said, she would be excellent. I said, she, that was my father used to say, don't take any tea for the fever. I said, she takes no stuff. She's exactly the kind of young Black woman our girls need to see. She's smart, she's intelligent, she doesn't take any stuff off anybody. She stands up for what she believes. And so that was it. And we worked the whole summer, not without friction, but counselees, seven of them, decided we should be a pair. And I was driving her and counselees back one evening, and they saw Dr. Zhivago was playing at the Village Theater. And they said to me, John, have you seen Dr. Zhivago? I said, no. About 10 minutes later on the way to Chester, Diane, have you seen Dr. Zhivago? No. Get a little closer to Chester. John, yes. We think you should take Diane to see Dr. Zhivago. Mm-hmm. I look back. If Diane was so mortified, if she could have shrunk into the back seat, she would have. I thought, I know she didn't do that. She thought, I would think she, I said, I knew you would never do anything like that. By the time we get to Chester, the girls are in an uproar, seven of them. One of them, Maria Harmon, is actually, she should have been a basketball player. She was about 5'10 or 5'11. I'm confronting 11 girls who will not get out of the van until I agree to take Diane to see Dr. Zhivago. And so I said, look, I'm going to take it. So just get out of the van, please. So they got out of the van. And going back, she said, I bet you, I said, don't even say anything. I know you did not put them up to this. I know how mortified you are. And I said, but there is an unfortunate aspect of this. You are going to have to come with me to see Dr. Zhivago, or they will kill me later on. And so we went to see it, didn't like it, but we talked for 4 hours. And after that, by the end of the summer, we decided we should make a go of it. So we dated her senior year and then got married before we both went to Germany for me to do my dissertation. But that's my, I guess, my version. My activism was really focused on young people and kids. I wasn't that much into what was going on campus when I was there and leaving in 66. The campus really heated up when they had the sit-in and Courtney Smith died. And we were going out at the time, and I was probably coming out every weekend to study and so on, hang out, because I had a lot of friends. I'd work out with in the wintertime, work out with the wrestling team, and then come up and eat and hang out. And the sit-in, and I'm thinking, hey, the sit-in's going on all over the place. And I didn't think anything about it. I thought, hey, it was fine. Hey, people are doing it. That's not my style. But hey, different strokes for different folks. I appreciate it. If that's your style, do it. My style is I'm a loner. I'm going to do what change I'm going to do. I'm going to do myself. I don't like taking repercussions from what other people have done. I can handle whatever I do. And I've been a pretty good amount of trouble with administrations in Tennessee and Georgia for what I've done. But I'm retiring now and I've survived them and they haven't. But the main thing is that when it happened, and I noticed when I was out there that there were a lot of guys from Franklin and Marshall who were coming on campus, sort of. And I thought, oh, what are these boogers doing from Franklin and Marshall? And they were going around telling women, told Diane, you don't speak. You let us speak for you. I didn't have to be there. My future wife looked at him. She said, nobody speaks for me except myself. So understand that. You say what you want to say, but don't try to put any words in my mouth. There was also an odd thing there. There was a fellow there from Life magazine whose name I forget now. He wrote an article about the sit-in, and she didn't participate in it. And I'll explain why, but when the article came out, he portrayed her as some jive talking, almost ignorant young Black person. And my wife is a master of the English language. In fact, she can slice you to ribbons with her without ever laying a hand on you. She's so good. And we read that and I said, what does, all right. And I'm out there and all these white kids that I knew are mad as about the Black kids doing the sit-in. And I said, wait. They were going to blame them. I said, no, you can't do that. I said, no, I'm not sitting in. Diane's not sitting in either. We're independent on this. I said, it's their right to sit in. But I'm going to tell you a story now so you can understand that Courtney Smith's death is on Courtney Smith. It's not on the Black students. I taught classes in College Hall at the University of Pennsylvania at that time. The history department was below the president's office. So the president's office is this hub of the campus. And they were having sit-ins and stand-ins and radicals talking every day on the campus. And the best day of all, I was coming in and I'm out there and this Black radical from West Philly, which is where I live, is up there, man. And he's actually gotten the president to come out. And the president was this elderly. I mean, yeah, Courtney Smith was like in his 40s. I think he was late 40s. Penn president Gaylord P. Harnwell, white haired elderly gentleman. And he came out, and this ends his tirade by saying, Gaylord Harnwell, you've been fucking around. And Harnwell looked.